Excited. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Pony Development Sync for Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. My name is Sean Allen, and your ringmaster today will be Joe, reporting from Green Space. Captain Green Space, please take it away.
Yeah, so I think we can start with we have an RFC and final comment period, which is one that we discussed heavily last week. Is it ready for a vote, or is it not ready until tomorrow? Let's see. Final comment period 6 days ago. Okay. Well,
Let's call that ready for a vote.
Okay. So I think the consensus we kind of reached last week was this is okay as a temporary measure, and we'd like to get something better as a permanent measure later, but that might take a while.
Yep.
Does anybody have any concerns they want to voice that are outside that consensus?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we can mark it as accepted then.
Excellent.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Benoit. We have a couple other RFCs to discuss.
Benoit, can you do the create the issues and everything for it?
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. I'll add it to okay, rebase and merge. I'll do that. And I'll drop a note right now on the words for last week in Pony. I'll add a link for that, Matthias.
Thank you very much.
Or actually, Benoit needs to update the script. He needs to update the stuff first. So can you drop a link to it on last week in Pony after you do all the updates and file rename and everything, Benoit?
Yeah, okay.
Cool. All right.
Yeah, so we have a couple other RFCs that have popped up since then. RFC pull request 122 is one from me about adopting George Steed's model for viewpoint adaptation from his paper. My only outstanding concern about this, well, I think there's two outstanding points. One of them is in the unresolved questions section. I have the caveat that I may not have properly understood the formal model. And so having somebody verify that would be nice as kind of a double check. I kind of ran through the George was kind enough to include the prologue code at the end of the paper. And so I was able to kind of mentally run through that and try to translate into some layman's speak, almost, mostly layman speak. If anybody's available to kind of double check my rendering of the formal rules, that would be cool. I know I have the tables right because those are just lifted directly out of the paper. So,
yeah. Cool. I mean, the sort of trivial version of George's work is that it's safer to extract an ISO capability from an ISO than you might think. There's some ad hoc stuff in the compiler that actually does a small part of that in an ad hoc way that is, the more interesting part of it is, in my opinion, the difference between non-extracting and extracting viewpoint adaptation. And I think that's what will impact the user too.
Right. Yeah. So one of the points to mention here is that there will now be two syntaxes for referring to viewpoint adaptation. One of them referring to non-extracting, one of them referring to extracting. In this RFC, I chose to keep the current viewpoint adaptation syntax as referring to non-extracting, and then add a new syntax for extracting that turned out to be, I think Paul mentioned that this same syntax was something that was kind of came up with independently in another discussion. So maybe that means it's good.
Yeah, I'm slightly fond of it. I think that's wise to keep the non-extracting with the existing syntax, since it's the one that most closely matches. Right? It involves the least change. Basically, we'll get a slightly more permissive capability out of existing viewpoint adaptation. I don't think it'll even break any existing code, although I'm probably wrong. And then the extracting one just gives you a more powerful tool.
What if it did break something, that would be just a compilation error, or?
Yeah.
Okay. Just checking.
Yes. Well
checking. Yeah. I guess another question. So does this, when you talk about the ad hoc stuff in the compiler, is that referring to things like safe to write function?
No, actually, safe to write isn't ad hoc. Safe to write, well, not ad hoc is an interesting thing. Safe to write is part of the original work on the type system. So, for example, it's about what can you put into an object. For example, safe to write says it's absolutely fine to put a val into an ISO, but it's not cool to put a ref into an ISO, because now that ref may be aliased in what is logically a different region.
Right.
No, there's some stuff that is in there, or was in there. I'm not sure. I cannot remember if I removed it or not. That said, oh, look, under some circumstances, you can pull a something ephemeral when you're reading from something ephemeral. And I think that's the thing that's in there in an ad hoc way, but which is formalized by George. Yeah.
Okay.
But I wouldn't swear to it that it's still in there.
Do we know off the top of our heads about whether this different viewpoint adaptation model is going to affect anything that might cause issues with the existing like auto recovery that we have, automatic receiver recovery? That is,
I don't think it should make any difference for automatic receiver recovery.
Okay, I did not think so, but I wanted to just check in about that.
Very reasonable.
Yeah. So, one of the reasons why I've been wanting to push for this to happen sooner rather than later is because it'll actually enable some other interesting patterns, like if you want to have a type parameter, string ref, actually let's use a better example, TCP connection notify ref, and you want to say, okay, I want to use that type parameter, but here I want to, you know, have it as an ISO instead of as a ref, because you can't tack capabilities onto type parameters. This is actually an interesting way to solve that problem, because you can do ISO viewpoint your type parameter, and now ISO viewpoint ref is ISO.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Well, if there's nothing much else to discuss here, another RFC, so I'm not hogging the limelight here, we'll jump to Benoit.
Do we know who would be a good person to review this? Is there somebody? Sylvan, maybe? You?
Well, I was just looking over it. The absolutely best people to go over it would be George or Paul. The tables are right, as Joe says. I've just been reading the rules, and they seem fine to me. I can't say that's like the most in-depth analysis in the universe, but it looks right to me.
Because the tables are right, as long as the tables are right, the implementation will be right. It's just a matter of making sure that for posterity we're expressing the right stuff.
Yeah. And the rules sound right to me when I read them. I think you've done an excellent job. So, yeah. Again, if we can grab Paul or Paul's on the call. Hey, Paul.
Hey.
And I just pinged him on. I sent him the thing on Slack. Hi, Paul.
Hi, I just joined like a second ago. It seems fine. The only thing is George had a slightly different definition of subtyping as well, where like ISO is not a subtype of ref. And I don't know if it's orthogonal to the viewpoint adaptation stuff or not. I think it is, but I'm not too sure. I have to think more about that. But other than that, it seems fine.
Right.
IRC.
Right, because he used the in some sense single element lattice, where he was saying he wasn't distinguishing the capability from the ephemerality for building the subtyping lattice, and so he was saying no, you have to be ISO hat to be a subtype of ref.
And that's
a perfectly reasonable way to look at things. And possibly a simpler way to structure the compiler, to be honest. But I think it's orthogonal to these changes. But yeah, if you wouldn't mind having to think about it, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll double check this week. But other than that, I think RC is fine.
Cool.
Okay, yeah. So to jump over to 4 days ago, Benoit opened pull request 124, which is about adding some more clarification around the trust boundary, and also adding in some new compiler flags to replace the existing --safe flag that would interact with annotations.
Cool.
I think Paul has already given a comment about this. I'll just let others chime in as well. I personally am excited about the idea of having an option in between Safe Pony and FFI that would allow you to do some pointer math for some efficient data structures. And then create that as a package. And then from there, people would trust that the package is implemented just like they trust the standard library to use pointer math.
I'm pretty sure you could do FFI with pointer arithmetic. Like, I don't understand the point of having them on two different levels of unsafety, and I think they're both as bad.
Yeah. FFI certainly enables pointer arithmetic, but pointer arithmetic absolutely enables FFI. It makes me extremely uncomfortable to talk about introducing escape hatches.
Can you define escape hatch?
An escape hatch is where you get to violate the type system, usually to try and gain performance where the type system is holding you back. So FFI is logically not an escape hatch in that it says, hey, we're going to talk to something that's outside of the programming language, and we can't make guarantees about something that's outside of the programming language. Okay, fine. The ideal situation is that all libraries eventually are written in the programming language, but that's, you know, a transition period that lasts roughly forever. Right? Like, that's just true for everything. But to introduce a direct escape hatch for pointer arithmetic is really problematic. I don't know if people are familiar with a project called Rust Belt. It's a project that Derek Draper is involved with, and The idea behind it is that they're trying to do formal verification of Rust libraries to show that they're using unsafe Rust code in a way that is not only functionally correct, but is composable. It's a big project. It's found a bunch of problems in Rust. And anything that would involve introducing additional unsafe code like that means taking on a formal verification burden. And I don't think that's wise.
Yeah, so I mean, my counterpoint to that would be that Pony, the language, has, for example, array, which is required to be in the built-in package because only the built-in package can use pointer math, and because, you know, we can't have a nice array without pointer math.
Indeed, that's why we can't have nice things.
Yeah. So I mean, there are definitely data structures out there that I would like to have access to in Pony that are implemented with pointer math and like array is. And I want to isolate my trust, just like I isolated it to say, okay, I trust the built-in package. I want to be able to say I trust this other package to do something like array. Like really, for example, let's say that you had an extra method you wanted to have on array to do some like shuffling in some, you know, efficient way. And for whatever reason, it wasn't general enough, or for whatever reason, we didn't want to pull it into the standard library. I mean, you'd be kind of, you'd be stuck implementing it as like a C library and calling out FFI to use it, which seems a little unfortunate to me. I don't know.
If there are methods over array that require internal access, certainly stuff, if it was actually necessary, should go in the standard library. And if not, people can actually replace their local implementation of array, right? That's a thing you can do if you have to do. Your point about additional data structures is interesting, though. I don't mean to put you on the spot. I apologize. It's a terrible thing to do. But do you happen to have one off the top of your head that you're thinking about? And it's totally okay not to. Like, I'm sorry to even...
I did 2 or 3 weeks ago when we discussed something like this, Sylvan, on that Saturday call. Yeah. But unfortunately, I don't remember what it was and what we discussed.
Totally reasonable. I don't mean to put anybody on the spot. It's not nice. But if
anyway. I guess one would be, I think a while ago I was looking at DJ Bernstein's Critbit trees.
Uh-huh.
That would be an example of a data structure that, I mean, and really, like, any data structure that's built on array, like, well, let's say you don't even want to do the pointer math yourself. Let's say you want to use something like array, but where you could, do bulk accesses, in some kind of loop or something like that, where you had already checked the bounds once, you don't need to check it again. And as long as you're passing indexes that are lower than, within the bounds that that are checked, like as long as you can verify that yourself, like manually at the call site, a way to say, okay, no bounds checking for this block. There's a ton of data structures that would benefit from that are just built on top of array, with this sort of like opt-out mentality. And I think it's, for a lot of those cases, it's fairly easy to verify manually at that point. But again, if you want formal verification, that's another story. I think some component libraries might not need that.
Well, the problem is that you just get into this situation of the language is actually no longer a safe language. And because as soon as you have a library that's in any way using this stuff that's in any way popular, it's not just in someone's completely private implementation, then it's, oh, look, that's just a language that relies on unsafe hatches. It's not a safe language. It provides to be honest, frankly, zero guarantees until, and even after proven correct, the history of problems found in proven correct code is disturbing. So it really is it's a very serious problematic thing to open that up.
How is that different than array right now then though?
It's the issue is that there's a certain amount of stuff that you grit your damn teeth and you bear it. And it's the same thing to do with, you know, how is it different from implementing a garbage collector, right? Well, the difference is that there's logically speaking a trusted computing base. And inside that TCB, you're all bets are off. But by controlling the size of the TCB, you control how much, what your vulnerability surface is. And if we open this up outside of built-in and we say there's data structures that can be written outside of built-in, all of a sudden our TCB is unbounded. And sure, people are having to opt in and say, oh, I'm happy to use this, but this is, it's not that I don't want to solve the problem of having these interesting data structures. I do. But I think doing it by allowing pointer arithmetic is not the best way to do it.
Isn't the solution right now that I do all of this in C with pointer arithmetic and I wrap a thin pony layer around it?
No, not at all.
That's not how somebody would solve it right now?
I certainly hope not. I think something to look at is, I'm very interested in what Joe was saying about how there's some bounds checking issues, because there's all kinds of other ways to address bounds checking issues that don't involve introducing unsafe code. For example, value-dependent types can eliminate bounds checking. It doesn't even have to be full dependent types, but simple value-dependent types can often eliminate bounds checking. We could start looking at compilation techniques over lambdas as parameters, as generic parameters to functions, such that we can have bounds checking elimination, right, where you can say, okay, I really do want to get into the internals of the array, but manipulate it in a safe way, but using a lambda that then gets compiled in and eliminates my bounds checking issues to solve the performance problem. There, I think it's super important, super worth looking into.
So what you're saying is let me see if I understand. You don't want to provide an unsafe escape hatch. What you would like to do is, as data structures or whatever come up that people want to implement that have these issues, to find safe ways to allow people to get the efficiency that they want.
Yeah. Obviously, it wouldn't be on a per data structure basis, right? We figured out for data structure one, we figured out for data structure two, we figured out some commonality, and we have something generic that we can expose that allow more complex and interesting data structures like what Joe wants to look at. I think CryptBit trees is a fantastic example, by the way. That's really good.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think I'm having trouble following you down the path of saying that adding this RFC would increase the size of the TCB. I mean, I think it's already unbounded. You talk about it becoming unbounded when we add this, but I think it's already unbounded by the presence of FFI. And I mean, you can say that, well, we can't do anything about FFI. So I mean, it's a loss that we can't, like, if we want interoperability with C code, then it's a loss that we can't avoid because we can't type check the C code. I mean, you could say that, but the TCB is still unbounded, right? Like,
No, I disagree with that. Okay. Having FFI gives you a very solid boundary. It says that pony code is safe, C code is not, right? As soon as we say, never mind, pony code isn't safe, to be honest, unsafe hatches have a long history in languages, and they mostly mean what you have is an unsafe language and you should give up on your type system because it's not worth it. I know that sounds a little bit harsh.
It's not that it's harsh. It's just that I'm, when I look at this RFC, I see an intention of trying to create something that is, it gives you the same amount of control that we currently have over choosing to trust packages for FFI and choosing to not trust them for FFI. Like, I think it's...
Yep. And there's all sorts of different ways that people approach this in other languages. Capability passing is one of them. Like, there's all kinds of different ways to do it. Nevertheless, creating a situation where the language is inherently unsafe is extremely problematic, right? It changes the nature of the language.
So just to probe this a bit, and try to make sure I understand your view, how would you feel about the situation of we have some C functions we expose that basically act as pointer apply, pointer update, you use them with FFI syntax, but we make sure that they get in whatever way is necessary, we make sure that they get compiled down to where it's not any more expensive than just doing the pointer arithmetic directly, but it uses the FFI rules at the language level, and the FFI syntax, and it's indistinguishable from FFI in every other way.
I think it's problematic. We're still creating a situation where expecting people to write pony code in a way that is unsafe. And that's not the purpose of FFI. The purpose of FFI is to say you have an existing piece of code. It's not part of your current development effort, and you need to use it.
Okay.
And creating a situation where the language says, no, this is the right way to write a data structure, is fundamentally different from saying this allows your language to call into libpcre, for example, into libssl. It doesn't. We're not saying with that, hey, the right way to write libssl in Pony is to write it in C. What we're saying is we don't have a SSL implementation in Pony. Here's how you get to an SSL implementation. And I think, I really do think they're fundamentally different things.
Yeah, I think, okay, thanks for clarifying your point. I think I understand you better now.
Cool.
Can you put that point on the RFC comments itself, Sylvan?
I think sure.
I think it's a very good point.
I have a question based on that discussion, Sylvan.
Cool.
So what do you think about unsafe math as it exists right now in Pony?
Well, funnily enough, that's something I wanted to ask you about, because unsafe is an interesting term for the math operations that we have, right? Because they're not actually unsafe in any kind of, in the sense that, maybe you can explain to me why they're unsafe in the same way that pointer arithmetic is unsafe.
So, as I explained in the RFC, I think unsafe math is less unsafe than pointer arithmetic or generic pointer operations, because right. With unsafe math, you cannot cause memory corruption or things like that.
Yeah.
But as implemented right now with the corresponding LLVM instructions, unsafe math can cause undefined behavior in the LLVM definition of the term. It's for most unsafe math operations, it's a soft undefined behavior, which is, so to explain it summarily, LLVM has two kinds of undefined behavior. You have immediate undefined behavior with, for example, dereferencing an invalid pointer, which can cause a lot of trouble. And you have the third undefined behavior, for example, on integer overflow. If you say that integer overflow is undefined behavior, which is basically a garbage value. So when I was writing this RFC, this was the approach I was taking to make the difference between undefined results and undefined behavior as defined in the RFC.
Yeah. So from an LLVM point of view, this I suspect you're already familiar with the work that Nuno Lopes has done on undefined versus poison behavior in the LLVM backend.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think the semantics that I detail in the RFC can only be implemented in Pony with the work on undef and poison.
Yeah.
Or something similar.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think it's just a vote for Nuno. That's really excellent work. And if you guys are interested in the backend compiler stuff, it's worth reading. While this may be an issue of accidentally provoking a path in LLVM that leads to miscompilation, it's not actually a Pony language unsafety issue, where those operations should always be correctly compiled by LLVM. And yeah, Nuno has found some cases where they're not, but those are cases where invalid optimizations are being performed because of as he says, undef is not enough, right? Like there are cases where just saying, it could be anything. No, actually you just can't. It needs to be clear that there's a difference there. But that's an LLVM backend issue that we don't have to actually be solving inside Pony. So in some sense, I like that you've drawn a distinction. I think the distinction is extremely strong distinction, to the point of I don't think it's ever problematic to allow Pony style unsafe math operations. I don't think that's anything that should require a capability or a compiler flag. Does that make sense?
Okay, then there is just a concern I have with unsafe integer division.
Uh-huh.
Because in LLVM it's an immediate undefined behavior.
Yeah.
But it can cause memory corruption, but it can terminate the program with a signal or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that would be problematic with the things you explained earlier on the call.
It's not great. You know, that's why Pony's default division, it always includes a test for zero in the denominator, right? I can't say I'm super fond of it. if processors had division by zero instructions that didn't trap, we'd use them. You're right. It's an edge case. I'm not sure which side of that lies on.
All right. So then the general idea would be to keep things as they are right now and investigate how to get safe patterns with pseudo pointer arithmetic, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing that we need is a case where we're not producing properly optimized code and doing some work to figure out what kind of a technique would allow us to produce properly optimized code for that specific data structure implementation. And then once we're there, we have something, okay, great, we've got it for that one data structure. That is nice, that is good, but to see what can be taken from that, what can be generalized, right? What and use that as a way to say, okay, this is how we expand what we can do in a safe way, instead of allowing pointer arithmetic outside of built-in. Primarily, I suspect one of the most powerful techniques we would have would be generic parameters to functions, specifically lambdas as generic parameters and value-dependent types.
Okay, so do you want to make a summary of your arguments on the RFC toolkit?
Sure, yeah, sure, we'll do.
Okay, thanks.
All right, I think we're past the halfway point now, so we can open it up to if people have specific things they want to discuss, they can raise those now.
I have a type system question, probably for Sylvain or Paul. Could you define what the lower bound of a viewpoint is? Because upper bound, I can understand that when I look at the implementation of capability lower bound for viewpoint, there are things I don't understand.
I will try, but with the fair warning that the implementation may well be wrong, in which case I apologize profusely. So the upper bound is all possible capabilities generated by the viewpoint operation are a subtype of the upper bounds. And the lower bound is the capability that is a subtype of all possible subtype permutations produced by the viewpoint adaptation operation.
Okay, thanks. So then I think there are indeed some bugs in the implementation. For example...
Not excellent, Sylvan.
Yes, all found bugs is excellent because they were definitely there even before he found them.
Yes, but the existence of the bugs is not excellent.
There's always bugs. Anyway, Benoit, keep going.
Yeah, so... read as seen by ref. So according to the implementation, the lower bound of that is read. And I think that's incorrect because some implementations
because it allows read. Substitution.
Is right. It?
So it is as if the read in question is bound to the same it has the same binding. So for any given binding of read, that's true. But if it's allowed to be a separate binding, yeah, that's not true. So one of the issues is making sure about whether or not it's the same binding. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think.
Can we talk about that a bit more? Actually, the whole same binding having these different subtyping rules because you know same binding. I'd be interested to hear more about that if you can expand on that a bit.
Yeah, and this is where I continually wonder if basically, I think probably we need a separate concept of a capability binding and tracking it as a constraint. And actually, eventually, I want to rewrite the type system, the type checking rules, not the type system, the type checking rules to be entirely constraint based. So basically, if we have as ref sees hash read, there is no real capability hash read. Hash read just says, hey, you know, we're accepting ref valor box here, and that's fine. This is just a shorthand essentially for a union type over ref valor box, except that it's not a union type over ref valor box. It's at all. In fact, what it is a specific instantiation that may be ref, val, or box. So let's call that specific instantiation K. So if we have as ref sees K, where K is in the set, hash read, then the lower bounds of as ref sees K is clearly K. And in fact, the upper bounds is also K. Does that make sense?
Right.
The lower bounds of the set hash read is absolutely not the set hash read. The lower bounds of the set hash read is transition. And the upper bounds of the set hash read is box.
Yeah, so I think one of the places that this runs into trouble potentially is like when you talk about type parameters being bound to each other, right? Like when you talk about the same binding,
yeah.
How does that apply to like a transitive binding?
Uh-huh. You mean such that where you have A has some binding is B and B is bound to A?
Not necessarily what I was picturing, but it's you have A constrained by B, and wow. B is hash read, and you're looking at your example of what turns out to be A hash read.
Yeah,
and you know the cap of B.
Yeah, yes, that's a fantastic example. And that's why I think using capability bounds that are separate from type bounds in the AST would help this situation, because we could have some unique K such that when B is bound, if B's upper bounds is any hash read, but B is actually bound, you know, B could be bound to, you know, a collection of things, but then instead of saying the capability of B is hash read, instead the capability of B is some K sub B, right? It's this particular kappa that B was bound with. So that if A is bound to B, then we know that its capability is not hash read. Its capability is K sub B.
Right.
Sorry, did I go off the deep end there?
No, I think that makes sense.
Okay.
Just a question of, the next question I'd want to ask is something along the lines of like where do we go from here to bring, when you talk about, you said you wanted to move toward a constraint based type checker. What's our roadmap for getting there? What does that look like? What work can be done now? And so on.
So, I mean, that's an excellent question. I think writing a constraint-based type checker for Pony actually wouldn't be that hard, right? In some sense, you were looking at George's prologue. That's what his prologue does. Well, it's not an entire type checker, but you know what I mean. That's the purpose of the prologue is to be essentially a constraint based type checker. To be honest,
yeah, I don't think you too, because it's kind of like we need a mini prologue interpreter or engine behind a prologue interpreter inside the type checker.
Yeah. I mean, writing it as prologue is, you know, a bit of a performance anti-pattern, as they say. No snickering. but writing it, you know, writing the constraint-based stuff in either in C, or we could, you know, in Pony for Pony CC with a Kanban, not Kanban, that's the damn agile stuff, Kanban stuff. Basically any kind of logic language or logic library, I should say, like that would be good. It could even be done in without using those specific mechanisms and in some sense rolling our own that's more specific to the type system. I don't think there's any changes in the type system that are necessary to do that. I think what would happen is we could, in some sense, have, if people wanted to work on that, we could have a project to do that and slowly replace bits. And having such a constraint checker would also magically make a lot of things that seem hard right now seem really easy. For example, all of the code to do literal inference could just go away, because the constraint-based system would solve that precisely every single time. It would make inference for generic parameters pretty straightforward, because with a constraint-based system, right, we can, it's sort of bidirectional in some sense.
I think I was having a lot of these same thoughts when I was dealing with implementing array element inference and lambda inference, is that it ends up being a lot of really like brittle ad hoc sort of checks that should be more elegantly handled to avoid bugs.
Exactly. And having a constraint-based type checker would essentially allow us to build something that handled all of these cases all in one logical way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Along those lines, I wanted to bring up real quick issue ticket that I filed earlier this week about IfType and returning something from IfType. It's 2667. That's issue number. Paul already replied to it with basically the idea that the type checker needs to carry extra information away from the IfType block to reach the point of where we do the check of whether the return type of the body matches the return type of the method signature.
Yep.
Yeah, so does this tie in here to this constraint-based system?
Perfect example. Because, a fantastic example. A constraint-based solver would see if type and say, okay, we have a new constraint over A.
Right.
A is absolutely a subtype of bool. Is true a subtype of A given that A is a subtype of bool? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and our constraint solver would treat, I guess, each if type branch as a separate pass so that it has to check.
It's not even a separate pass. It's just building a constraint within that bounds, right? We know that that's the case inside if type because it's we wouldn't be in that branch if we weren't. So within that scope, A has the constraint is subtype of bool, but it doesn't outside of that scope.
Yeah, well, actually, the issue comes up because we're talking about the comparison happening outside of the scope, right? The return, and maybe this is just an issue of the fact that the return type is evaluated outside of the scope.
Exactly, and with a constraint-based checker, it's really trivial to check that from within that scope.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly.
Okay, well, did you name a C library a second ago when you were talking about constraint? Did you have anything in mind that I should take a look at if I wanted to dig into this?
That's a really good question. So Mini CanRen is probably the most interesting approach to logic libraries. It isn't a logic library, but Mini CanRen, K-A-N-R-E-N, is an approach to logic libraries. There are many implementations of many CanRen and many languages, including, I know that one was being worked on in Pony. Sean, do you know the status of that by any chance?
What status of what?
John Mum's mini CanRen in Pony that he was working on.
I do not know.
Okay. Here's the thing though, writing a mini CanRen is hilariously simple. I try not to say things like that because all things are harder than they seem, right? But you can just knock it out. It's brilliantly put together. And there's so many existing implementations that it's pretty easy to have a look around and go, oh, I like the way this implementation did it. I like the way this implementation did it.
Okay. Well, I'll dig into that at some point in my copious free time.
Yeah. Actually, as a specific Kanran implementation that's easy to follow and works it works very well. I don't know what would possibly be surprising about it. Is Go Logic, which is a mini Kanran implementation in Go.
I did one for Rust a few years ago.
Ah, excellent.
We should get you to do this, Gordon.
Did you do Rust Kanran?
No, I called it Logic RS.
Okay,
excellent. I mean RS Logic. RS it's probably Logic. Broken now because
wow.
Syntax has probably changed.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have things they want to bring up here on the call?
One thing I just wanted to let people know, I'm going to be opening an RFC to add callbacks to every single notifier. I think that's probably in the Pony standard library to add one that gets called when the enclosing actor is disposed, because you can use the runtime back pressure stuff where you yourself apply back pressure and create a scenario where the application won't be able to shut down, because you could have an actor which applies back pressure on itself via something like a notifier, like a TCP one, for example, which is suggested as a way to do that in the current documentation. The problem would be is that if it needs a way to release that at the point in time when it's told to dispose of itself, otherwise the thing which sent it a message to dispose of itself will be marked, will be muted because it's sent to an overloaded actor. So you need to have a way to be able to complete the protocol that you started where you marked yourself as overloaded and remove that from yourself at the point when you receive a dispose message. In the case of these ones which are built in, or if you had written your own class, to turn it off if it was on at whatever point in time that you might be disposed. Because otherwise, you can use the tools that are currently there to deadlock things. So there'll be an RFC coming for that.
Cool.
And it'll explain how you can do it.
Sounds good.
I figured that out when I was talking to Sylvan earlier. It's like, oh, wait. That's how you can do that.
I had one thing. As you might have seen, I backed away from using Subtree for the third-party library. And because some things are coming down the pike in Git that should make it easier, hopefully in the next release. But I think we're going to be doing a release sooner than that, so I wanted to get the latest Google Bench into Pony. Well, it turns out that the version I have is broken on Windows, and I'm just updating it now. I was surprised that my previous PR was passing the test. Well, it turns out it wasn't. App there wasn't enabled, so that's why it was passing. And that the bug that was found has been fixed on Google Benchmark. But of course, they haven't done a release. So, in the short term, just to make sure that it's working, I'm grabbing the current head of master, and I'll be pushing that up shortly. So hopefully, that'll make that Google Bench now work, and we can choose to pull that into the next release if we want.
Excellent. So for my own edification, what are the changes coming in Git to do with submodules or subtrees?
It turns out that if you try to rebase a subtree directory, it doesn't rebase. It doesn't get rebased. It just is broken and doesn't work. There's a partial fix for it, which is a parameter called parse merge, but that turns out also to be broken. And then there's a new change coming in, which is called rebase merge, and or rebase merges, and that does work as it's currently implemented on a working branch, done by somebody else, not by me. And so I'm hoping that'll be going in the next release. But of course, you know, I have no control over that. But what we currently have, I have some documentation on how to use parse merges, but it's just ugly and error prone. So okay. I'm hoping. Well, the rebase merges. It's kind of fortuitous that I was happening to look at this because rebase merges did not work on subtree until I pointed it out to the person who was implementing it, and he quickly fixed it, and so now it's working really well. So. I hope maybe by the next release that we have following this one, we'll be able to use subtree if we so choose. There's one other problem that I mentioned, which is the handling of tags. That's a little less of a problem, but it's still not pretty. It turns out that if you do a fetch of a different unrelated history into your current repository, and you then fetch the tags, it will overwrite any tag that's in this fetched repository will overwrite any tags in the existing repository. So as it turns out at the moment, none of the tags in Pony would conflict with, for instance, the tags that are in Google Benchmark. but that's not obvious. That's obviously not a good solution. So the short-term solution is you put the no tags flag when you do the fetch, and then there isn't a problem. The better solution is, why in the hell are they putting it in the global address space? Well, it turns out that, well, that's just kind of like the way it's been. People have recognized that this is a problem in the past, but nobody's ever gone to the trouble of trying to incorporate a fix. So I posted this as a problem on Git, and Junio responded back, says, well, yeah, that's a problem, and here's kind of a workaround you could do. But anyway, I'm gonna see if I could get that fixed with hopefully some help of other people. But it's a little less of a problem if you simply do no tags, then it's not going to conflict, and this isn't something that I introduced or anybody else. It's just the way it's been.
Okay.
So hopefully, if we're lucky, both of those problems will be fixed when we move forward. But we'll see. No guarantee.
All right.
One other quick thing. I have a proof of concept for LLVM. And has anybody got any feedback as far as even thinking about it. So what I've shown here is that we can build CLang within the Pony repository and create a working Pony using that compiler. With the advantage being that we can more precisely control what LLVM we're going to be, we need, and not have to support every version that's out there. So that's the rationale for doing that.
All right, cool.
So is it something I thought the Clang versions were actually separate from the LLVM library versions. Like you could use Clang 3.3.9 with that. So this would be a convenience so people don't have to install Clang, but it's the LLVM library stuff that's really that. Yes, am I making sense?
Yeah. Building Clang.
It's. I was not sure. So I had some months ago, I had created a WebAssembly tool chain with LLVM and CLang. And so the easiest thing I could do was just bring that. Actually, there are three sub-projects within the LLVM. There's LLVM, there's LLVM tools, and then there's CLang that I brought in. And I just, you know, rather than trying to see, well, gee, if I wanted to compile LLVM 6.0 with CLang 3.9.1, is that going to work? The answer is, I don't know. But I do know that if I pick up CLang 6 and LLVM 6 and LLVM tool 6, those will work together. So that's why I chose, at least for this proof of concept, that we have all three of those in there. If it turns out we don't want, and we just want LLVM, we could do that. But I, as a short term, I brought them all three in. And that has, you know, a slight advantage also is that, for instance, I added WebAssembly output. And if we want to add WebAssembly as a target code base, the standard releases are not going to have WebAssembly at this time. So by having CLang within our control, we can add it easily.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's based on the LLVM libraries, not the version of Clang that we would use to build the Pony compiler. So Clang is essentially unnecessary to us, right? And any arbitrary C compiler that links the Pony sources together with our LLVM implementation is fine. It's the LLVM implementation that would control whether we had various backends available to us.
Yeah.
All right.
But it also turns out you can use that version of CLang to compile the library. Excuse me, to compile Pony. Which would on the face of it would seem advantageous if we had our own compiler.
I don't think we want a version of Clang that's built. It's fine to use any arbitrary system installed C compiler. It's really the LLVM library that makes the difference. Building Clang itself is not what we should be doing. It's fine. It just doesn't matter which C compiler we're building with. And so building a C compiler isn't needed. It's really the LLVM libraries.
Okay.
We're over time, I'm afraid.
Oh, yes, we are.
So who's wrapping it up?
Joe is our leader today.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I will say thanks, everyone, for coming. And we'll see you next week.
See you, everybody.
Thanks.